Okay, good afternoon, everyone. We're going to shift the gear a little bit away from Lady Gaga.
Although I appreciate you meeting my requirement that Lady Gaga opens for my talks, which is, I request that everywhere I go. You guys were great.
We try very hard.
Yeah.
So we're going to talk about Israel, and no better person to have on stage than Dan Senor, who co-authored two New York Times bestsellers. The first, I'm sure many of you have read, Startup Nation, The Story of Israel's Economic Miracle, and published on November the 7th, a month after October the 7th, but written before October the 7th. Dan's new book, The Genius of Israel, The Surprising Resilience of a Divided Nation in a Turbulent World. And Dan also has a highly recommended podcast called Call Me Back, where you can get up-to-date analysis of everything that's going on in Israel. So thank you for being here, Dan.
Thrilled to be here.
Israel, a topic that divides opinion, stirs up some emotion.
A little bit, yeah.
Despite that, I think there is mostly admiration for a very small country that came from humble beginnings and is now a global leader in innovation and entrepreneurship. Help us understand how much Israel has punched above its weight.
So it's a tiny country of about 9.2, 9.3 million people. It's a speck of territory. It's smaller than the state of New Jersey. It's surrounded by adversaries, in some cases outright enemies, as we are reminded over the last few months. It's been in a state of war since its founding. For most of its history, it's had no access to natural resources. It's largely an immigrant population, and it has managed to be home today to the highest density of startups in the world, of any country in the world. It attracts more global venture capital on a per capita basis than any country in the world. On an absolute basis, it attracts more global venture capital than most European countries. There are more Israeli companies listed, startups, tech companies listed on NASDAQ than companies from China, from the US, from Canada.
Wow.
Multinationals, there are about 420, depending on how you calculate, between 420 and 450 multinationals in Israel today. So some of the biggest tech companies, from Palo Alto Networks to Microsoft to Meta to, and then not, you know, Apple, it's most, one of its most important R&D centers outside of Cupertino is in Israel. And then non-tech companies, Walmart, Procter & Gamble, Coca-Cola, most automobile manufacturers have major R&D centers in Israel for technology reasons. And it's important to keep in mind, most multinationals that set up facilities around the world, they either do it for logistical reasons because they want to, you know, access markets or have supply chain issues in certain regions. So getting a beachhead in a certain country gives them that advantage. With Israel, no multinational gets that because Israel is mostly shut off from every country in its region because of the boycott of Israel, the very well-organized boycott of Israel. Or they do it to access the domestic market, but there's no domestic market in Israel. As I said, the population's a little over 9 million. So the reason all these multinationals are piling into Israel and have been over the last couple decades is because of Israeli ingenuity, Israeli brain power, Israeli capacity to solve very perplexing problems for these companies in some of the most innovative ways.
So I want to talk a little bit about how Israel has achieved this. One of the components that's often cited as one of the main reasons is the fact that Israelis have to serve in the IDF, the Israel Defense Forces. Before we talk about what that means for innovation, can you shed some light on how important an institution that is in Israel?
Yeah, so Israel's the only country in the world today whose military service, national service, it's not just military service, it's national service, the sense that most Israelis at formative ages in their lives are serving in a cause larger than themselves, and that institution is almost like the organizing institution for the society. So just the basics. Most Israelis ages 18 to 21 are required to serve. So you finish high school, and instead of applying to university, you go right into the army. And males for 3 years, females for 2 years, unless you go on to serve in the officer corps or you go to try to get into one of the elite units, which can take longer. So it's about 3 years. And then if you have reserve duty. So we're hearing in recent months about all these reservists that are being called up. Most Israelis serve in reserves through their 40s. So they, about 2 to 4 weeks a year, even during peacetime, they get together with their reserve unit. So they have this incredible bonding experience with people from all walks of Israeli life in the military during those 18, 19, 20-year-old years. And then they get back together with that group every year from all walks of life, people they would never associate with. So you have the son of a tech billionaire and the son of a cab driver, you know, one from bustling Tel Aviv and another from a struggling town on the periphery of Israel, one that's hyper secular, one that's very religious. All these people get cobbled together in these military units. They not only serve together on behalf of a cause that's larger than themselves, and they bond with each other, but they also have this experience with each other throughout most of their adult lives, and they develop extraordinary skills that I don't think anyone anywhere in the world can gain at that age, that I think serves them well for their pursuits, whether it's joining one of these multinationals or starting a company on their own.
So what is the secret sauce of the IDF that cultivates a spirit of innovation and entrepreneurship?
I'd say a few things. One is the IDF, when you talk to military experts who compare the IDF to other militaries around the world, they say that the IDF is unique and that it drives decision-making down to the most junior ranks of the military. So there are no militaries in the world, including the U.S., where the most junior people are empowered with some of the biggest decision-making, not only life and death decisions, which are extraordinary, managing lots of people at a very young age, managing huge assets. And the IDF is deliberately understaffed at the senior levels. And that was a theory that carries over from the founding years of the IDF, where they basically said, we are going to be outgunned and outmanned by our enemies. That was the theory of the founding fathers of Israel, given that they were up against an array of these countries throughout the Arab Middle East. And the only way they could make it is if they were edgier, more improvisational, their military. And the only way you get that edginess and willingness to take risk and improvisation is if you drive decision-making down to the most junior levels and let people make those decisions on the front line and not be burdened about the stakes or be burdened by the consequences if they make a bad decision. So they really inculcate a sense of risk-taking. And so, again, military experts, military academics who study this say the IDF is the only military that is so, it's almost like anti-hierarchical. So that's a big factor. Secondly, Israel has built within its military a number of tech-focused units. So you hear terms like, you know, for people who invest in Israel, 8200 or Talpiot or 9900. These are, each of these units are, when you go serve in them, it is like getting a PhD from MIT or something. You serve 8 or 9 years, it's tech-heavy, it's tech-focused. And a lot of the big tech companies today and VCs recruit directly out of these units.
So in essence, the unit that you are able to get into as a teenager graduating high school is more important maybe than your academics? Or
much more important. I mean, when you are trying to raise capital from a venture fund or you are applying for a job at a startup or a multinational, they rarely ask you where you went to university, although Israel has, you know, world-class universities there, like the Technion, the Weizmann Institute, Hebrew University, Tel Aviv University. They have world-class universities, but what they all want to know right away is what unit you served in. That is, those units are like the Harvards, Princetons, and Yales of Israeli society. What's interesting, which is a big focus of our new book, is how that serves Israelis in terms of developing a talent pool for the tech economy, also helps keep the society together. It doesn't matter how talented you are. If you want to get into 8200, Unit 8200, which is like the closest Israel has to like the NSA, and it is academically like MIT while serving in the military. If you are extremely talented and you have all the academic qualifications, if you do not know how to operate as part of a team, if you don't view yourself as part of a community, if you don't have a group mindset, you will not get into that unit. That is very well known. So raw intellectual and analytical horsepower only gets you so far. And Israelis know that. They're trying to get into these units at age 18. So think of all the years leading up to 18, 14, 15, 16, 17. The incentive system is, I got to be damn smart, and I got to view my role as being part of a group and a team. And they are equally important. And so if you compare it to how we reward people when people are applying to elite institutions in the United States, particularly colleges, it's all about me. What's my GPA? What's my, you know, SAT score? What are my reference letter sets? It's all focused on the individual. And in Israel, the incentive system is much more focused on how you view yourself as part of a team.
Got it. And the IDF isn't the only reason for Israel's success. I think one of the most striking things is the astounding amount of immigration that Israel's had since it was founded in 1948. I think it was founded with about 800,000 people, and there are 9.3 million people in the population today. How important has that been to fueling the ecosystem? And what can people learn from immigration and integration policies?
So there were about 70 nationalities represented in Israel today. Two out of every three Israelis are either an immigrant themselves, the child of an immigrant, or the grandchild of an immigrant. So when you spend time with Israelis, you are spending time with people who Hebrew is one language, and then they speak another language, and it just depends on where they come from. Do they come from Eastern Europe? Do they come from Australia or the U.S.? Do they come throughout North Africa and the Arab Middle East? Many families are from Yemen, Morocco, Iran, Egypt, Turkey, all throughout Latin America. What it means is that, A, it is an immigrant culture. The country was built by immigrants. It has an immigrant mindset. And what you find with immigrants in most parts of the world, they tend to view their whole lives as startups, right? They have to go to a new place against enormous odds. They have to immerse themselves in a place that they're not familiar with challenges that may not be natural to them. They have to know how to deal with adversity, and they have to build something. And so not only is that a metaphor for most Israelis and their lives or the lives of their parents or grandparents, but it's a metaphor for the life of the nation. And I think that has a huge impact on the entrepreneurial culture, A. B, because it's such an export-oriented economy, right? The biggest contributor to Israel's GDP is its exports, and specifically its tech exports. So you have tech companies in Israel that have to be comfortable dealing with all parts of the world. And in an increasingly globalized world where there's a premium put on your ability to engage with the outside world, when you have a country with all these nationalities where they're speaking all these languages in their homes, it's just an enormous advantage.
Got it. This is a room full of investors. Mm-hmm. A robust tech ecosystem needs capital. Mm-hmm. And attracting capital in a new market can be really tough. You have to get people to actually come and see what's going on. That's the only way you change perceptions of a place. Just like LA and Hollywood and all these people coming to Upfront Summit today. How did Israel do that? How did they get people to come and attract capital?
So there were two channels. One was Israelis often worry about brain drain, about Israelis leaving Israel, coming to places like LA where there's a big Israeli community, or Silicon Valley, the Bay Area, where there's a big Israeli community. I think they overstate the risk of brain drain. I think what's more common is brain circulation, which is what we talk about in our book, which is Israelis grow up in Israel, they serve in the military, and then they go work usually in the U.S., increasingly London and Berlin, for 2 or 3 years, go work in a big tech company over here. And then when it's time to start their own family, they wind up going back to Israel, and they've become, by that point, incredible ambassadors from wherever they're coming from when they go back to Israel. And so that's the story of Intel in Israel. Intel is one of the largest employers. I actually think it's the single largest employer outside of the government. It's the largest private sector employer in Israel. Massive, massive facilities. They're one of the first. Dov Froman, Israeli guy, went and got his PhD at Berkeley and got to know Andy Grove and others at Intel, and they had a shortage of engineers. And Dov Froman said, hey, I know a place where we can find quality engineers. Let's go set up shop in Israel. And so part of it is that ambassadorial group of people who are circulating around the country. The other is the Israeli government set something up called the Yozma program. They knew they had incredible tech capabilities and tech talent. They knew attracting venture capital was hard, so the Israeli government set up this program to basically seed fund any venture fund that would set up shop to invest in Israel, so long as it involved foreign capital partnering with local talent, and the local talent would be trained and mentored by the overseas, the international VC talent. And I won't go through all the terms in the interest of time, but it was a very generous scheme, generous deal for those who are willing to deploy capital and take that kind of risk in Israel early on when it was not common. I'm talking 90s, basically, late 80s, early 1990s. What's interesting about the Yozma program is it is one of the only government programs that I know of that was launched, funded, clearly met its mission, and then shut down. I've been involved in government over the years. Most government programs, no matter what those who conceptualize the government program say at the beginning, once the government program is built, once it's funded, once there's a staff and a bureaucracy working on it, good luck shutting it down. It always finds a justification for why it needs to continue. Yozma is one of the only, if not the only, government program I know it launched. It had a clear mission. It basically seeded a venture capital industry in Israel. And then once they had enough key players, they shut the thing down. And today, as I said, they have this flourishing venture capital scene.
So I can't let you being on stage and today pass without talking about what happened on October the 7th. If 2023 had ended on October the 6th and the history of 2023 in Israel was written, it would have been about an incredibly divided nation with many different parts of it at war with each other, religious, secular, political, one state solution, two state solutions. And then suddenly on October the 7th, when maybe Israel was at its weakest, they had the largest terror attack on their population that they've had since they were founded and on the Jewish people since the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. How has Israeli society responded from being in that position to where they are today?
So I'll say a couple things about that. First, you can't overestimate the scale of the attack against Israel on October 7th and the trauma that overhangs it. That is to say, if you look at in proportional terms relative to the size of its population, it would be like about 30 9/11s happening in Israel on a single day. But imagine 30 9/11s happening in Israel, but it just wasn't a single day, because the day after October 7th, there were still terrorists roaming around about 20 communities in southern Israel as Israel's trying to battle them. So the threat was still there. And then it wasn't only 30 9/11s, but then there were all these hostages taken, the equivalent in U.S. proportional terms, something like 10,000, be like 10,000 Americans being taken hostage. And so there's not a single Israeli who is not directly affected by this. That is to say, I live in New York City. Obviously, 9/11 had a huge imprint and impact on the city and on the nation. And yet, I remember even after 9/11, you could go to many parts of the country and people were following what happened on 9/11. They were curious about it. Obviously, when the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan began, it became a focus of a lot of interest. But there wasn't a sense that every American had a stake. Every single Israeli either knows someone, family member, a friend who was killed on October 7th, has a family or friend who is being held hostage today, right? So like I interviewed for my podcast a few weeks ago, this incredible woman who is a reservist. She's an architect by day. She's a reservist in the IDF unit that is responsible for preparing the bodies of deceased female IDF soldiers for burial. Now, she was called up for reserves the weekend of October 7th because suddenly they had all these female soldiers that these bodies needed to prepare. And she is one of the first people who started to identify this pattern on all these bodies she was inspecting, where she says, oh, wait, they weren't just killing these women. They weren't just mutilating these women. There was sexual assault was used as a weapon of war on a very consistent basis. And in the context of my conversation with her on my podcast, she not only talked about this, but she also talked about her life today. And her life today is she's married, she has four children. In any given week, they have three funerals to go to, three shivas to go to. And the family has to divide and conquer. Like, okay, I'll go to this one, you go to that one, because they're about the same time. And she was visiting, she told me on the podcast, she was visiting her doctor the week before, and she said, oh, how are you doing? She was just checking in, regular checkup. He goes, well, my nephew is in Gaza, in a tunnel being held hostage. Just sort of, it's everywhere. And then you add up 360,000 reservists called up in a country of 9.2, 9.3 million people who are fighting and now dying in this war. And so every aspect of Israeli society is affected. And yet, as we argue in our book, Israel is it's almost the inverse of the United States, right? The United States is a country with strong institutions and a very weak society. And we can have a whole conversation about the polarization of our politics. We can talk about the loneliness epidemic in the United States. We could talk about the deaths of despair. We could talk about the mental health, the teen mental health crisis. These are all issues we talk about in our new book. And in Israel, it's the opposite. It is a country with very weak government institutions, which we saw in most of 2023, which is with the judicial reform debate. Israel doesn't have a constitution. So weak institutions, but an incredibly strong and resilient society. And what you saw on October 7th is Israelis from all walks of life. The turnout for reserves, so the IDF did its reserve call up, depending on the unit, the average turnout for reservists was between 120 and 140%, meaning they overshot on the number of reservists they called up because they didn't know how many would show up, and more showed up than they could put in roles. People who had aged out of reserves, people older than 40 years old, were coming and saying, I want to serve. Israel's population in the month of October increased by 3%. Imagine your population increase, because Israelis living abroad were all flying back saying, put me to work. So the commitment to service in the military was there, but also the volunteers in civilian life. There were so many holes and so many gaps in basic government functions on the civilian side. And Israelis from all walks of life, from secular to religious, Israeli Jews, Israeli Arabs, they have all stepped up in a way that, as dark as this moment is incredibly inspiring. And I bring it back to what I was talking about at the beginning, which is this idea of the society being anchored around this idea that you're part of something larger than yourself. Now that culture, that mindset, sure, as you know, is great in a startup scene, right? Is if people working in startups feel like I'm part of a team, I'm part of a mission, you know, I'm part of a group effort that's larger than myself, that's very powerful. It's great in the health for the life of a startup. It's also great for the life of a nation, particularly a nation that has been on the receiving end of such a big setback as Israel has been. That sense of the whole society feeling that they are part of something larger themselves matters right now.
So I know we're running short on time. I've got a couple more questions, but I must ask you this. We've witnessed a surge in anti-Semitic attacks and protests against Israel outside of Israel. I think that it's had a profound impact on diaspora Jews that didn't necessarily realize the connection they had with Israel. I want to ask you a really challenging question, but when does anti-Zionism become anti-Semitism?
My answer to that question, and I say this as someone who over the years has been very critical of different Israeli government policy decisions, and I welcome anybody who is critical of Israeli government policy decisions to articulate their criticisms. Israel's a better society for those criticisms. In fact, spend time in Israel with Israelis, and they are some of the most outspoken critics of their own government policies. The question I think you're asking is, when does criticism of Israel become discriminatory? And it is when any country is held to a different standard than we hold every other country. So I'm very critical of policies of the Chinese government. I am at times very critical of policies of the Canadian and British governments. I know many people are very critical of policies of the US government. At no time do you hear people say, well, this makes me question America's right to exist, or let's have a debate about China's right to exist. These are countries, they're populated by a lot of people. People are living their lives there and building their lives there and trying to live with some semblance of normalcy. And it's so preposterous and unfathomable to say to those people, we're going to have a discussion about this country you live in, whether or not it has a right to exist. And somehow with Israel, the criticism of its policies is often morphs into a debate about whether or not the state should exist. That is a form of discrimination. You don't apply that standard. People don't apply that standard to anyone else. Also, you ask any country that is subjected to the threat. Israel has a genocidal threat on its southern border, as we saw on October 7th. It has a genocidal threat on its northern border. Hezbollah is a bigger threat to Israel than Hamas in southern Lebanon. They have 10 times the manpower, 10 times the weapons capability, and they talk in the same genocidal terms as Hamas does, not to mention the threats from Iran and Syria. Israel is not free of making mistakes. It's not always innocent, but it is trying to do its best to defend its country and defend its security in a very dangerous neighborhood. And the U.S. and other countries have gone to extraordinary lengths to combat threats against these Western countries. The fight against ISIS, which took 9-10 months and involved leveling communities and many more civilians killed on a per capita basis than what the Palestinians are experiencing in Gaza. Not that that's not terrible what's happening to the Palestinians in Gaza, but countries that are under siege have to deal with threats. And so criticism of Israel doing this or Israel doing that is fair. The question is, are you asking Israel to do something different than you would ask any other country? And if you do that, I think you have a problem with the country not with the policies.
Got it. So last question. I'd like to end maybe with some hope.
Mm.
Just prior to October the 7th, I think we thought there would be a Saudi-Israeli normalization agreement. Is that still possible? And if it was achieved, would it have a positive, profound effect on the region?
I think that we don't appreciate how close Israel and the Saudis were before October 7th. They're even farther along than was reported. And I think one of the reasons the attack was organized was to prevent it from happening. And I think the Saudis are as committed today as they were on October 6th. You can just see it in their public statements and in private conversations I've had with different Saudi officials. They are very focused on this. Obviously, the political environment's gotten more complicated for them, but they're still talking about normalization with Israel. Not because the Saudis have become Zionists. Not because they're like, you know, philo-Semitic, you know, rah-rah, like we want to celebrate the Jewish state, because they believe it is in their own interest. Given their strategic and economic and innovation and tech-focused aspirations, they believe they have a Silicon Valley in their backyard, Israel. They don't have to fly 15, 18 hours to this state, no disrespect to the state, to innovate. They can innovate with the Silicon Valley right there in their backyard. And obviously, they have shared strategic interests. Both Israel and the Saudis are concerned about the threats from the Islamic Brotherhood and Hamas and also Iran. And so for Saudi to reach its own goals, its 2030 goals as they've articulated them, they need to co-innovate and partner with Israel. That has not changed. The important thing for Israel now is to demonstrate that they cannot be bullied in their own region. And if they get hit as hard as they did on October 7th, that they can restore their security, they can restore their deterrent effect, because as much as the Saudis want to co-innovate with Israel, they also want to believe that Israel is a military and intelligence juggernaut, and Israel has to restore that perception of strength and not look like a paper tiger. So oddly, it's sort of counterintuitive. The Saudis want to see Israeli strength right now. They want to see the restoration of Israeli deterrence, because that's partly what they want to piggyback onto. And if that happens, the Emiratis and the Bahrainis were important, and that wouldn't have happened without the Saudis. The Saudis blessed it. But Saudi Arabia normalizing with Israel is like Egypt normalizing with Israel 4 decades ago. It is the most powerful country, the most powerful military, the largest economy in the Middle East. And once that happens, the Israeli-Arab conflict is over. That's it. Both sides say that, by the way. That's it. If Saudi Arabia normalizes, then it's okay for everyone to normalize. And the Middle East, when you think about the amount of capital, natural resources, and now technology capabilities from Israel that can be integrated into this broader region, I think the Middle East has the potential, ironically, after what we're watching right now, which is a civilizational struggle, ironically, the Middle East has the potential to be one of the most promising, innovating, economically growing, future-oriented centers in the world.
Well, let's leave it with that. Thank you so much for your insights. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.